Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 72, Soul Medicine, January 20th, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
What we're finding in psychology is that many of the problems we think of as psychological problems, like fears, phobias, depression, also have some kind of electrical or magnetic effect or aspect. For example, a recent study of something called pulsed electromagnetic fields has shown that patients with severe depression who can't be helped by antidepressant drugs can be helped by changing the rate at which the magnetic pulses in their brains fire. And there's a huge and growing body of scientific research now in this field.
That was the voice of my guest, Dawson Church, Ph.D. Dr. Church has edited or authored over 200 books in the field of health, psychology, and spirituality. Most recently, he is the co-author with Dr. Norman Shealy of the 2006 book, Soul Medicine, Awakening Your Inner Blueprint for Abundant Health and Energy. Beyond this, he has collaborated on articles with many of the leading voices of our time, including Larry Dossey, Bernie Siegel, Carolyn Mace, Neil Donald Walsh, Gay Hendricks, Houston Smith, and John Gray, among others. He earned his doctorate in integrative healthcare at Holos University under the mentorship of distinguished neurosurgeon and our prior guest, Norman Shealy, MD and PhD, founder of the American Holistic Medical Association. He went on to receive a postgraduate PhD in natural medicine, as well as pursuing clinical certification in energy psychology. He's founded Soul Medicine Institute, a nonprofit institution dedicated to education and research into science-based medical interventions which use consciousness and energy as primary modalities. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Dawson Church, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much.
Yes, I'm really glad to have you here. And I've only just discovered as we were talking just before this recording that, in fact, you're only about 10 miles away from me.
Yes, and sometimes we don't discover those things till the last moment.
Right. It's funny that we haven't run into each other before. Are you living in this area or just visiting?
Yes, I have for many, many, many years, actually. I've lived in Northern California.
Huh. Okay.
It's also a hotbed of ideas and practices, I find. It's an intensely creative area, and so you find many, many different therapies, people, creative endeavors here that are a constant source of inspiration to me.
Yes, and to me too. Now, I noticed that you have a bit of an accent. Where are you from originally?
My father was a missionary, and so we traveled quite widely. I was born in Cape Town, South Africa, and then spent time both there and also in the U.S. and in England growing up. So I wound up with an amalgam of all those cultures, as well as being really having a feel for third world cultures. And so a lot of my work and writing tries to emphasize the nature of healing as much more than just a coming from the first world allopathic perspective, the technological medicine perspective, because things like shamanism have been with us a long time and now again are yielding new gifts and insights as we move into a more holistic way of seeing healing.
Definitely, and we'll be getting into that in just a moment. Just want to let you know that I have at least two or three listeners that I'm aware of in South Africa, so they might be particularly interested in what you have to say here.
Good.
Yeah, I had previously had a very interesting interview with Dr. Norman Shealy, who's your co-author on this book, and
yes, and
that was about one of his other books, and then you collaborated with him on this one. How did the two of you get together?
I first became aware of Norm and his work in the early 1980s when I began writing about alternative medicine. And then it seemed very alternative and very far out. And many people could not see the convergence happening today between conventional medicine and what we now think of as alternative medicine. Norm was one of the first pioneers to really see that convergence. And he, in fact, as you will recall, is the co-founder of the American Holistic Medical Association.
Yes.
Which he founded in the 1970s. And so Norm was really a pioneer in this whole field. And so we'd known each other for some time that way. And then when he founded Holos University in 2000, I again hooked up with him and wound up collaborating with him through this project.
Okay.
So again, the book's called Soul Medicine because we really wanted to trace the origin of the idea academically and scientifically of the influence of spirit and soul on the practice of medicine.
Okay. Now, I've had several listeners contact me asking to hear more about energy psychology. And I saw on your website that one of the research initiatives at your Soul Medicine Institute is the first database of energy psychology clinical case histories. So perhaps a good place for us to start is to ask you, how do you define energy psychology?
One of the things that we defined in the course of Soul Medicine was what we call the three pillars of Soul Medicine. And one common aspect of all these therapies is they treat the energy system of human beings. And by energy, I'm not referring to any kind of mysterious energy. I'm talking about the electrical energy field of human beings and magnetism. Those two things are very well understood. They're used in treatments like the pacemaker, which uses an electrical pulse to make the heart pump at a regular rate, the MRI machine, which everyone knows about. So these kinds of therapies which affect these fields of the human body are starting to be recognized for the power that they have. And what we're finding in psychology is that many of the problems we think of as psychological problems, like fears, phobias, depression, also have some kind of electrical or magnetic effect or aspect. For example, a recent study of something called pulsed electromagnetic fields has shown that patients with severe depression who can't be helped by antidepressant drugs can be helped by changing the rate at which the magnetic pulses in their brains fire. And there's a huge and growing body of scientific research now in this field. So we found that that there was this aspect of psychology as well, where you can affect sometimes a deep-seated psychological pattern like long-term depression or like a phobia or a fear. Pain, for example, often has a psychological aspect. And you can affect these things by the simple application of very, very basic electrical fields applied to the human body. And by basic and simple, I don't even mean hooking up to wires or currents. I mean just the electricity you induce by rubbing or tapping on your own body. And that's the whole field of psychology that I see developing in the next while. It's very, very, very low-tech sort of method of affecting the psychological conditions just by physical stimulation that produces electrical waves that then seem to go and have an effect on the psychological problem.
Is there a book that you would refer people to if they wanted to learn more about this particular approach of the physical tapping and so on that you just described?
Yes, David, there are several books. And the one that I refer people to most often is called The Promise of Energy Psychology. Gary Craig is one of the co-authors of that book, and also Donna Eden and David Feinstein, who co-wrote the book Energy Medicine. And so that book is an excellent reference and resource. And then I'm working on a book on all the science behind this, because one of the criticisms of this field has been that there isn't enough research in the field.
Right.
And it's a valid criticism in many respects. But I found about 300 scientific studies that support this idea. So I'm putting those in a new book, which will be out later this year, called The Genie in Your Genes. And it describes how these things affect roughly 100 genes in our bodies that are called the immediate early genes, which are activated within a few seconds of a stimulus. So there's a genetic component to this as well. And so that book will lay out the science behind this. And then as far as the practice goes, in plenty of case histories, I'd refer people to Gary Craig and David and Donna's book.
Okay, well, I look forward to your book coming out. You certainly are a prolific writer, I must say. On your website, it said that you were involved with something like 200 books or articles. It's
yes, I've either co-written, ghost-written, or edited several hundred books. I think I counted up, it was 17 in the last year alone. Mostly that's helping other people clarify and put their ideas out there. And then occasionally I'll write one or co-author one myself. But this is an area where I feel this area of energy psychology and medicine is one I feel has such tremendous potential that I'm trying through the database and through these books to stimulate awareness of quickly. Because when you see a patient, say, for example, one example comes from a colleague and friend of mine, Eric Robin, at Kaiser Permanente, and he had a patient come in who had she was a young woman in her 20s with persistent urinary tract infections, or UTIs in medical speak. And she'd had these UTIs for years, regularly recurring, and so he looked through her case history files at Kaiser and saw that she'd had a history of these UTIs. And so rather than just prescribing the usual treatments for her, he tried energy psychology, and he did a brief session with her. And these sessions take, 5-10 minutes, they're very, very quick. And he first of all identified the underlying emotional issues behind her UTIs with her. And that took like an hour. But then he did this energy psychology session with her, took a few minutes, and her UTIs, that UTI cleared up immediately, and she never returned to Kaiser for that problem. I think 2 years later, she was still clear of them. So when you see people have been suffering from depression or anxiety or some deep-seated trauma that's been affecting their lives for years, and you suddenly see this person relieved in just a few moments, the results are almost hard to believe. I do these sessions with people during my lectures and talks often, and even I, having done dozens and dozens and dozens of these treatments on people, will watch with amazement as somebody whose life has been made miserable by some issue for years suddenly is able to gain some relief or some freedom from it.
Okay. Well, having gone through traditional doctoral training in psychology, I either am blessed with or suffer from a certain amount of skepticism, and I vacillate in terms of whether I look at it as a blessing or as a curse. So we'll come back to that, and I'll share with you some of my own skeptical questions here, which I'm sure you'll address. But let's get into your book. What was the initial motivation? What was the idea behind the title, Soul Medicine, and what was the initial motivation in doing this book?
It was severalfold. One was that Norm Shealy is one of the greatest authorities alive today on the history of electricity in medicine. And he is the holder of several patents, and he is honored in the Surgical Hall of Fame for several of his inventions. For example, his Gigatens machine puts out electrical impulses which penetrate the skin and affect underlying muscles and nerves at the same frequency of vibration as human DNA. And so Norm is a walking encyclopedia of these kinds of treatments. And I did not know before I began writing with Norm just how long a history the use of energy, electricity especially, has been around in medicine. Virtually from the discovery of electricity, it's doctors tried to use it to treat patients.
Yes.
And so there have been reports of various kinds of treatment techniques around for about 300 years. And it's not a new thing. Norm Sheely's machine that's called the TENS machine, T-E-N-S machine, used by a lot of pain sufferers. But the first TENS machines appeared in the 1890s. So this is not a new approach. But as we discover more and more specifically about how the energy field works, we can then design machines and interventions that are much more precise. So that was one reason, was to show that this has been around for a long time, and that, interestingly enough, many of the effects that are obtained from these machines are also obtained by human intervention, especially by faith healers and laying on of hands. There's an interesting series of experiments by a researcher called James Joy, and he measures the emanations, the electrical characteristics of the hands of healers, and finds that the frequencies they emit are similar to those of TENS machines. So we're discovering that, in fact, within ourselves actually have healing powers that are echoed by these externally produced machines. And so this whole interface of technology and spirituality seems to be a lot closer than we previously realized. And so Soul Medicine explores both of the technological aspects of this, but also just the ways in which things like prayer, consciousness, belief, faith can have dramatic effects on health and longevity.
Okay. You know, you mentioned these electrical machines having been around for a long time. And unfortunately, or I don't know if it's unfortunate or not, but I think a lot of them have been associated with quackery of various sorts. And so I would think that would be a little bit of an uphill battle just because of that long history.
It's very mixed history. There are ads from the 1870s, just after the American Civil War, that say, become a radio enthusiast, only $9.99 for the machine, includes instructions. So there's a long history of snake oil. But for example, in 1924, a Dutch physician called Eindhoven won the Nobel Prize when he discovered that the heart, the human heart, has its own electrical field. And at the time, this required very, very sensitive instruments to figure this out. Later on in 1929, Hans Berger discovered that the brain had an electrical field. And the EEG and EKG and that class of machines was born. So there are these machines which are standard in practice and diagnosis today, which use these fields. And there's also a fair amount of, because the fields are invisible, people associate them with mysterious energies as well. But in fact, we try to focus on the science behind this, because science may lag, but it does eventually report to us what's going on.
Yes. Now, you two set out, you and Dr. Sheely, in part, set out to see if you could scientifically verify, to your own satisfaction, whether successful faith or energy healings do occur. And so you went around and you looked at case histories and so on, and also visited a variety of faith healers. How successful were you in that quest to develop scientifically verified case histories?
It does take some persistence and determination. Because so many people mistrust anything they can't see and write it off as quackery, even electrical impulses, which are obviously, we use them in every form of our lives, from the phones we're talking on right now to the toaster that we'll be plugging in the morning. So even though these fields are invisible, people associate them, I think, with the mystery because of that. And that's why science is so valuable in this quest, because it can help us debunk what is just either unproven or ineffective, but it also, if we're open, it helps us show what is effective. And for example, with faith healing, there's definitely something going on with faith healing, with prayer, and with belief. I'll give you one example, a recent study done last year at the University of Texas at Austin by a psychiatrist, Gail Ironstone. And I think she was published in the early part of last year. showed that she was studying patients with HIV, and she found that how well they did on measures, hard measures of their wellness, like their immune system, white cell blood count, were determined or were correlated highly with their beliefs, especially their faith beliefs. And so we're discovering that certain beliefs have a dramatic effect on health. And the particular belief she looked at in the course of her studies was their belief in God, and whether they perceived God as a punishing God or a benevolent God. And those that believe in a punishing God, over the course of their AIDS, their count of white blood cells dropped 4 times as fast as those who believed in a loving God. Now, that is a dramatic health effect from one single belief.
Yes, actually.
So we're realizing that, yeah.
Yeah, actually, Gail Ironson and her brother Dale Ironson were guests on the show in an earlier episode and described the research that
Wonderful.
You're talking about.
Yes. And you see, so researchers now are looking at these things, what mm-hmm. we call consciousness-based interventions, using your own consciousness to affect your health, when you realize that just your belief about God can have that enormous effect on your health. Suddenly you realize you have this huge ability to influence your health. In my new book, I show people examples of various molecules, and I show them what a model of a peptide looks like, what a beta blocker looks like, and histamine looks like. Histamine makes your heart rate increase. All of these molecules, and the molecules all look very different from each other, any one of these can be produced purely by our minds and our beliefs. And so as we think, there is this chain reaction of hormonal and chemical, biochemical responses in our bodies, and that chain reaction is affecting our bodies every day, and is affecting our genetic structure every day. One of the lesser known things here is that genes are turned on or off. Some certain genes are turned on or off by certain thoughts or beliefs.
Okay, that you know, you're down to that level, and I'm able to believe in that. And at the same time, I struggle with some of the kinds of healings that the book describes. I'm surrounded by people, by friends who talk about and believe in such things, but I have yet to have any direct contact with the sorts of healings that you describe. Now, I know that you and Dr. Shealy, sincerely set out to be as skeptical as possible in examining the claims of the healers you studied. I have the impression from your publication histories that you both start out as believers, though. So a truly skeptical outsider might question whether you two were sufficiently objective. What would be your response to that?
I think that science lags experience. And we know that something's going on because we see these kinds of effects. For example, doctors, in Soul Medicine, in the first chapter, we have letters from doctors where they're describing experiences with their patients who have had faith healing that are totally out of the realm of their medical experience. I posted a video on my website today which shows a woman with a height phobia, and the therapist worked with her for about 30 minutes. Actually, first of all, they were in a workshop in a motel, and he asked her to walk onto the balcony, and she couldn't even approach the edge of the balcony. She was terrified. And then 30 minutes later, she walks out there and looks at the view and says, how beautiful this is. And then 2 years later, there's a follow-up of the video showing that the effect holds. So those sorts of things will turn people who are skeptical into believers that something's going on. But what is going on is hard to define. That's where science comes in, and we'll have to spend probably years, decades even, mapping these effects. Like Gail Ironson was able to actually map that correlation between the immune system in two measures and also the belief. But that's, you know, one belief, one measure, and a long and costly study. And I urge people not to become impatient with research, because it does take time to catch up with what therapists and others are seeing experientially. Yes, skepticism has a role, but the honest skeptic also, when confronted with this kind of evidence, has to admit that there is a whole realm of healing potential in our consciousness that we barely begin to tap yet.
Yes, and to some extent, I'm playing devil's advocate here, taking a little bit of an extreme position. What is that website that people could go to find that video?
That video is on soulmedicineinstitute.org, and it's a little hard to find. You have to go to the trainings page, and there's a seminar that I teach to groups called the 3-Minute Stress Dump, and I post several case histories on that 3-Minute Stress Dump page, including the video is posted there as well.
Okay, great. I'm definitely going to look for that, and I really applaud the idea of trying to establish these sorts of healings on a credible scientific foundation. It's definitely a worthy goal.
I'll give you an example of that, David.
Yeah.
There are literally thousands and thousands of anecdotes posted on websites of people who have had remarkable healing using EFT, emotional freedom therapy. However, my question is, well, they may say they've been healed of, you know, cancer or heart disease or whatever, depression using EFT, but they're telling me this. I find it fascinating. It's a good pointer, but where is the proof? So that's why on that same website, we're starting a clinical case history database where we're requiring a medical diagnosis first. Now, if somebody shows me a doctor's diagnosis they had cancer and that they've ended EFT, and then a second diagnosis showing that they don't have cancer, that to me is impressive scientific evidence, whereas just the story is not. So we're trying to push not only this kind of evidence-based reporting all these case histories, but also more hard science measures of them. And Gail Ironson is a good example of hard science. She's measuring the number of T cells in our immune system. Mm-hmm. And that's a hard science measure rather than a soft measure, which I call soft measures, things like number of doctor visits, patient subjective feelings of wellness, things like that. Those are interesting to me, but what really gets my attention is when there are measurable changes in the proteins in our blood to do with healing, genetic expression, protein expression. Those kinds of measures are incontrovertible.
Yes, it would be nice if some of the more traditionally recognized bodies got involved with this. And I was under the impression that the National Institutes of Health have a division now for studying alternative and complementary medicine. Are they looking into this sort of healing at all, do you know?
To my knowledge, they are not. And in fact, the researchers I've spoken to are quite disheartened by the direction the NIH has gone in over the last few years. And apparently there's little or no funding. I actually raised money for a study myself at Kaiser because public funds weren't available. So there's a desperate need for funding to study this stuff. And I am doing whatever I can to scare up money to do more scientific studies. Right now we have 3 or 4 in the pipeline which are going to be furthered by additional funds. So there's definitely a need for government funding, private funding to study this, and the NIH is not leading the way. Now, that said, the NIH is very useful, for example, in setting standards, like our clinical history database. We're using NIH standards to report those case histories.
Excellent.
So by giving us standards, we're able to then report those histories in a way that complies with NIH requirements.
Excellent. You've given us a couple of examples already, but in the book you cite a number of case histories of successful healings, some of them quite dramatic. Perhaps you could share one or two or three of those that stand out in your mind as being most impressive.
I'd love to. One of the things that we ask people when they begin describing a problem is we ask them what their subjective intensity of experience is on a scale of 1 to 10. So, for example, the lady I mentioned about the height phobia, what we do is we ask, we say, on a scale of 1 to 10, how afraid of heights are you? And so she might say, she said in the video, I'm an 11 on a scale of 1 to 10, my fear of heights.
Wow.
So you get those initial scales, and then you ask people after the treatment, well, how do you feel now? And so what I've done is things, for example, I had someone in my office recently who, this lady was working here outside in the garden, and I noticed she was sniffing a lot, and she was totally stopped up. She was speaking through her very, very clogged nasal passages. So I did a quick treatment on her, again, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, very, very rapid, and because she was totally stopped up. And she said she had an allergy to grass seeds and flowers, mm-hmm. and that's why she was so stopped up, because all the grass was flowering that day. And she was speaking normally and clearly within a few minutes. So I ran outside, grabbed some grass stems with flowers and seeds on them, ran inside, held them, gave her as a bouquet, and said, congratulations. And she held them to her nose and continued to breathe clearly. Now, again, I am not aware of any other therapy which could produce that kind of rapid effect.
This is after you did what? What was it you did with her?
I did a technique called emotional freedom therapy, EFT. That's the one that is the most widely used. Of all the therapies in this class of energy psychology, EFT is the most widely used one.
Can you give a brief description of that process?
You know, it's a fascinating process. It takes me under 2 minutes. And if you watch people under stress, they do a very interesting thing with their bodies. You'll watch people do things like say, oh my God, and they'll raise their hands to their mouth or to their temples. Or somebody who's feeling upset, sitting at a desk, will rest their head on their hands, and their hands will touch their temples. Or the classic Victorian melodrama actress who gasps with shock and raises her hand and strikes herself on the chest,
yes.
Raises her hand, puts it over her heart.
I can see it.
What you found, very interesting, is that those points on the body actually have a stress release effect, that people's stress level goes down measurably when these certain spots are touched, and there are spots on the temple, spots on the face, spots on the chest, spots on the hand, that people often fidget with, and we found these actually reduce their level of stress. So what energy psychology does is it organizes between 7 and 15, depending on which routine you use, of these into an organized routine that you use consciously when you're under stress. So unconsciously we'll touch these parts of our bodies. What these methods do is people remember the stress or relive the distress. And then while they're reliving it, they touch these or tap or rub these parts of their body while the distress is in full bloom. And what this does is it appears to send a small electrical charge through their body to the physical site where that muscle memory or organ memory is held and release that electrical charge. Experiments have shown that the electrical charge on diseased organs is different from that in healthy organs. And so there's an electrical component to all of our illnesses. And these natural stress-reducing gestures seem to, when we push or rub on these points, send small electrical charges into our bodies. And these wind up reducing our stress. So it's quite remarkable to use this with a person and find that when they do this tapping and this rubbing, while recalling that distress, usually it has a big effect.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's very interesting. Of course, it makes me think of acupuncture and acupressure.
Yes, and in fact, all of these points are associated with meridian points and actually meridian endpoints. Each one of these points, like the woman gasping and holding her heart, the chances are that her sun is on a point called K27, 27th point on the kidney meridian, and that's a potent stress release point. So these do correlate as well with Oriental medicine and acupuncture.
Yes. Now, in the book, I think you also related a personal story of a rather dramatic healing. I think you had a broken ankle or something. I don't quite recall.
Knee, yeah. And I was doing it myself in that case. I actually had an MD doctor and two PhD biologists in the room with me, and had severely injured my knee while playing baseball in a remote camp. I was camping with a group of people, and we were miles, like an hour and a half from the nearest hospital, and I took a bad fall, and my knee, it was injured, and it swelled up, and so people were very concerned, and even the people there who knew about energy medicine thought that the injury was so severe I should go to the hospital right away. But I did, and it just I felt into that area myself. I sensed how my body felt, and I really couldn't feel any significant injury there. So I began to apply energy medicine techniques to myself. And whereas I'd been, I actually asked everyone to leave the room because people were just buzzing around. Everyone was all stressed out about the injury, and there was so much emotional distress about my getting hurt that it was hard to focus. So I actually asked for, I said, okay, you all leave, and in a half hour, I want to see what happens. And in a half hour, I will agree to go to the hospital. I want to go to the hospital if I'm not better by then. And I just applied these methods, and it was just quite remarkable. My knee, the swelling just went down very, very quickly. The redness disappeared, and I simply walked out of the room a half hour later, whereas before it required two people supporting me just to hobble around in great pain. So, yes, these methods do hold out great promise.
And the people who were with you were amazed to see that, right, because it was so severely swollen.
They couldn't believe their eyes. And in fact, that night there was a square dance at this camp, and I was just dancing at the storm, square dancing all over the place.
Amazing.
And when the caller said, okay, it's time to end, we all screamed out, no, and kept on dancing for another half hour or so. So I have seen, I mean, this is just one example with me, but I've seen many, many examples of the healing of severe distress. And of course, it has a potential for physical injury, but also for emotional injury. We know that most physical diseases have a strong correlation with emotional distress. There was a huge study of 14,000 people by Kaiser Permanente over 10 years, and it found that if you had significant, what they call adverse childhood experiences, ACEs, your chances of cancer, heart disease, diabetes, depression, all kinds of things, illegal, illicit drug use, all kinds of things correlate very, very highly with childhood trauma and general emotional trauma. And what we're finding is that if you release that childhood trauma, and especially when it comes up again as an adult, it's that adult emotional distress is a pathway which reawakens the childhood distress and through which you can help heal or affect the childhood distress. So healing these emotional distresses actually might look like psychology, but it's really physiology as well. One of my favorite phrases is physiology is psychology and psychology is physiology, because if you affect the one, you invariably affect the other.
Yes. Now, another major thrust of your book on soul medicine was to study successful healers to see if you could identify what they have in common. And in fact, you come up with a list of what you call characteristics of the master healer. So maybe you could just briefly give us an overview of those characteristics or list them for us.
Certainly, yes. And we do have a concern here because this area is not sufficiently overseen by professional bodies. In fact, one of the things I'm really encouraging is for healers to get certified. There are several excellent certification programs happening right now, and we'd like to see more and more healers actually taking tests and being evaluated so that the public has some kind of objective criterion that this person who's treating them has a certain level of skill.
Yes, that would be good.
And so, in fact, on my website, again, I have links to some of these certification programs, which are meant to actually test people and give them a basic knowledge of certain principles, which can be useful in this field. But we found that looking at just natural healers, people who are just naturally brilliant at healing, there are certain things that they have in common. And one of the things that we found they have usually is a strong spiritual practice. They're usually rooted in some tradition, whether it's Catholicism. We talk about Father Ron Roth, the Catholic priest in there, the Mac Nuts, who, again, he was a Catholic priest and had a very strong background in theology. There are Buddhist healers, there are Tibetan healers, there are Native American shamans. In fact, one study of AIDS patients showed that when they were prayed for by distant healers, whether they were Qigong masters or Lakota Sioux medicine men or faith healers from the Protestant Christian tradition, the patients did get better. And it didn't matter. It seems as though regardless of what one's beliefs are about God or in God, something about that strong spiritual tradition seems to impart or tap you into a state which permits healing. Again, brain scans, EEGs, have allowed us to look at the state that healers are on in during healing. And what happens is that during the healing moment, healers' brains tend, the overall brainwave tends to fall in the 7 to 8 hertz cycles per second range. So regardless of where the brain state is before or after the healing, during the healing they tend to be in that 7.5 hertz predominant state. So it looks as though that whether one believes in that healing is done by Mother Mary or by the Great Spirit or whatever one's belief system is, during the healing event, that brain state is a common one to most healers. So a strong spiritual practice is definitely a powerful indicator. Another is distance healing. We found many of these people can pray for others over a long distance. And while many of them do practice right where they are, in an office or in a city, or as they travel and touch people, we found that their interventions are effective over a long distance. So even if the patient is a long way away, this can be effective. And this is I do not fully understand, because clearly there's no electrical field. The heart's electrical field goes out about 15 feet from the human body. The brain's goes out a lot less. There's no way that you can explain by magnetism or electricity, the healing that's happening 50 miles away, but somehow it's happening. So I have no good explanation for it, but it does happen. So these people can heal over long distances. Also, intention. They clearly hold the healing intention. And it seems as though when patients get physically close to them, that the intention for health held by the healer overrides the electrical state of the patient, which may not have the same intention for health. But the consequence is that when the patient leaves the healer's proximity, the patient may then revert back to where they were before or regress in their health. So intention and proximity are two things which are simply intertwined.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm just concerned about time, so I think I will refer listeners to your book if they want to find out what some more of the factors are that you have unearthed, and also to read more of the case histories and so on, which are truly fascinating. To kind of wrap things up here, it seems like you've had a long-standing interest in consciousness and matters of the soul. How did this come about? And also, I'm wondering what you wanted to be as a kid, and how did that either lead or not lead to what you're doing today?
Interesting question. I think my earliest recollection at around 5 or 6 was going to be an airplane pilot. I think, to me, the intertwining of the physical world and the world of spirit and soul is an interesting one, because clearly things that happen on the physical level affect us energetically and at the spirit level. And just as clearly to me, we are beings of spirit and soul, and those things do have an effect in our external world. There are some amazing experiments, which I won't go into in any detail. I do in the book, but there's some experiments which show that intention in consciousness can affect physical matter in a very literal sense, can literally affect the structural molecules. So having a strong intention and having a consciousness of a certain order can literally affect the physical world. And so there's this interplay happening constantly between our consciousness and the physical world. These two things, I think, it's a fascinating exchange. And as we become more and more aware of the power of consciousness, I'm arguing that we need to go there first for healing. So, yes, there are drugs, there's surgery, there are all the wonderful tools of medicine, there's acupuncture, there's homeopathy, but I'd like to see people go there second and first look to belief, prayer, energy work, all the other ways of affecting systems, because we know that like iron filings are organized by a magnet, the structure of our bodies are organized by our consciousness, and just try to rearrange the iron filings, like through surgery or through drugs,
sure,
without affecting the energy systems, is bound to fail. So what these two books are a great argument for is when you get sick, when you get depressed, when you have any big life stress, first of all, see what you can do for yourself in consciousness, and then if you still need the tools of psychotherapy, if you need the tools of surgery, if you need the tools of modern medicine, great, they're there for you. But don't run there before you've looked at what you can do just in your own awareness, because your beliefs, your prayers, your thoughts are tremendously powerful and kind of make life or death changes in your health and well-being.
You know, that is a great wrap-up and would be a perfect place to close. But I'm still kind of curious about, was there a pivotal event or moment in your life, or was it the fact that your parents were missionaries? Where did you make that step into this world of consciousness and the physical?
You know, my earliest memory of something like that was standing with my father and a group of ministers, and I was perhaps 7 years old, 8 years old at the time. And I closed my eyes, and they were all in the circle praying, and it was a very conventional evangelical Christian prayer, nothing mystical about this prayer at all, but I could see these turquoise columns, like, of light going up above their heads, and it was a very puzzling experience for me as a child. It's like, wow, so I opened my eyes, and I couldn't see the columns. Closed my eyes, and clearly in my mind's eye, there was this column of something. And it seemed to intensify when they prayed. And so I, you know, looking back all these years later, I have no idea what that was. But experiences like that, and also mysterious experiences of healing, watching a person being prayed for and getting better, even sometimes when doctors had failed, or people getting ill through through their beliefs. There are many cases where people, it's called the nocebo effect. So the placebo effect is believing positively and having a positive health outcome. A nocebo effect is believing that some bad thing will happen, and it happens. So I just noticed that that people seem to be able to, certain people seem to be able to have a powerful effect in this respect, and began to study it. And science now is wonderful because it's showing us exactly what's happening behind the scenes with those effects rather than just being observed without us knowing what's going on.
Okay, well, I really want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio today. You're a compendium of very fascinating information, and I've really enjoyed talking to you.
It's been a joy. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Dawson Church. You know, at some point, I'm probably going to be repeating myself. After 72 shows, I can't always remember what I've already told you about myself and my opinions. So please bear with me if from time to time I repeat myself. This interview with Dr. Church is but one that has touched on the topic of healing. Living in California, I'm surrounded by friends and colleagues who have no difficulty at all in believing in all sorts of things that I personally struggle with. For example, lots of people I know are very excited about the power of prayer and healing through prayer, or the actual laying on of hands, as it's called, for healing. It's hard for me to judge how much of my own struggle with belief and disbelief of such phenomena is rooted in my exposure to scientific method and how much might be a sort of religious neurosis left over from my childhood. Let me explain. Because of marital difficulties between my parents, I was often shipped off to live with my grandparents way across town, sometimes for periods as long as a year. My grandparents were evangelical Protestant Christians who believed and practiced divine healing, laying on of hands, being filled with the Holy Spirit, and speaking in tongues. And of course, they too believed not only in angels, but also devils and demon possession. My grandmother was a particularly formidable woman who, in earlier years, had led revival tent meetings all over America. In fact, she got hooked up with my grandfather after he wandered into one of her tent meetings drunk and was converted by her and later ordained as a minister by her. My grandmother told me that before her revivalist career, she had been a successful banker, but that Jesus had appeared to her on two different occasions and instructed her to preach the gospel. Later, when she was running a church and Sunday school and divine healing newspaper out of her house, any hapless mailman or delivery person was likely to find themselves on their knees confessing their sins to God before they got to leave the house. This is what I mean when I say she was a formidable woman. Out of their home, my grandparents for many years published a newspaper called Healing Hope, which I recall may have had a circulation of around 20,000 people all over the world. People in need of healing would write in asking to be prayed for. And my grandparents would pray for them and also send them an anointed prayer cloth, a small rectangular piece of cloth which had been prayed over and anointed with oil and which the afflicted person was to place on the part of their body needing healing. I know my grandparents received many testimonial letters. As a child, I also attended tent meetings by various noted divine healers. I saw people who appeared to have been healed, but somehow was never fully convinced. Even though I tried hard to be a believer as a young person, and even convinced myself I was never able to experience speaking in tongues or the experience called being filled with the Holy Spirit or the Holy Ghost. I was student body president of my fundamentalist Christian high school, led prayer groups, and was generally considered to be a model Christian. However, in a variety of ways, I saw a fair amount of hypocrisy in that environment, especially in terms of religious and racial intolerance, for example, anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism among so-called Christians has always puzzled me, inasmuch as Jesus was a Jew. I finally broke with all this as a freshman in college. I could no longer subscribe to a fundamentalist form of religion in which innocent people were doomed to go to hell. I can't believe in a God who's less loving than me. So having freed myself from a lot of what I regarded as superstition and rigidity, imagine my consternation at finding that such things as angels, prayer, distance healing, laying on of hands, and so on is now in. Also, Dr. Church mentioned Catherine Kuhlman as one of the more effective healers he has studied. Well, it so happens that my mother went to a healing meeting led by Catherine Kuhlman at a time when my mother had been diagnosed with colon cancer. I'll never forget my mother and my sister calling me with great excitement about how my mother had been healed and how she was able to run around the block after having been very sick and having little energy. I felt guilty to be so restrained in my enthusiasm upon receiving this news, but there was a skeptical voice in my head. As it turned out, my mother went into decline not long after that and eventually died. It was bad enough that she had to endure the cancer, which led to her eventual death, but her pain was only magnified by the psychological and spiritual anguish of thinking that she had, quote, lost her healing because her faith was not strong enough, end quote. To me, this is the dark side of a lot of the New Age thinking I see around me. If you get sick, it's because you aren't thinking enough positive thoughts. Now, as you know, if you've been listening to the series, I do believe thinking positive thoughts, challenging negative thoughts, nurturing good feelings in yourself and others is wonderful medicine. At the same time, there is real danger when things don't work out of blaming the victim or blaming ourselves. Many times, whether among New Agers or fundamental religious folks, I've seen this blaming the victim. It can be very subtle and pernicious, and I think it's something to watch out for. Now, I also have to say that I recognize something in myself, in my podcasting, that's akin to my grandparents publishing their newspaper, Healing Hope. I'm also trying to broadcast a kind of healing hope, although a more secular version. I know my grandmother prayed over me and prayed to pass on her gift of healing and that I would carry on their work. Sometimes I wonder if perhaps her prayer was answered and is still unfolding.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
On the last podcast, I gave a little teaser that there might be some new developments in my podcasting career. The news is that starting in February 2007, I'll be creating two interview-style podcasts per month for the site mentalhelp.net. The name of that podcast series will be Wise Counsel. It will have a narrower focus than Shrink Wrap Radio. Where Shrink Wrap is quite wide-ranging, Wise Counsel will stick mostly to interviews with therapists and counselors, focusing on mental health and issues relating to the challenges of major life transitions. I'm quite excited about this opportunity, because the mentalhelp.net site gets a huge amount of traffic, and frankly, I'm hoping to drive some of that traffic here to Shrink Wrap Radio. Both Podshow and mentalhelp.net want original content, so I won't be able to recycle any of the content from one show to the other. However, I am allowed to do a second interview with a guest who's been on one show, you know, for the other show. So sometimes you'll find content that feels new on Wise Counsel, featuring a guest you haven't or won't hear on Shrink Wrap, and sometimes it will be a guest you have heard here, but with somewhat different questions being put to them. Shrink Wrap will always be my first love. Whereas I've sometimes put out as many as 5 or 6 shows a month on Shrink Wrap, I'm going to try to hold it to a steady 4 per month, leaving me with enough time and energy, I hope, to do two a month for mentalhelp.net. I haven't done my first interview for Wise Counsel yet, but I think that series will have a somewhat different feel. probably not dramatically different since it will still be me at the helm. So now you'll have two different places you can go for your Dr. Dave fix. And speaking of new psychology podcasts, listener and psychology graduate student Michael Benoit wrote to let me know that he's just started a new research-oriented psychology podcast, and he gave Shrink Wrap Radio a very nice plug in his first show. Thanks so much for that, Michael. Your first show was interesting to me, especially your discussion of self-deluded people on American Idol who engage in the mistaken self-assessment that they can actually sing and become superstars. Sometimes it's really painful to watch. You have to wonder how many of those people are just doing it, you know, for a to be seen on TV. But some look like they really are shattered to discover that they can't sing, and you just have to wonder how in the world could their self-assessment be so far off. Well, Michael cites some research that bears a bit on that. If you're interested, you can find out more. The name of Michael's show is Giving Psychology Away, and you can find out more at http://givingpsychologyaway.podomatic.com. That's .podomatic.com. As usual, we're happy to be sponsored by Podshow and GoDaddy. You'll find great discounts for all your domain name and web hosting needs on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. And don't forget, you can now purchase the first 50 Shrink Wrap Radio shows on two MP3 CDs for a fairly nominal price. Just go to www.poddisc.com, where Poddisc is spelled P-O-D-D-I-S-C. We've got one new addition to our Frapper map. I want to give a big thank you and a welcome to Jennifer in Paris. And Jennifer, thank you for the comments you left there. We seem to have a growing Parisian contingent. Vive la France! And there's a place on the Shrink Wrap Radio website where you can add yourself to our Frapper map if you're so interested. I'd love to see you there.
Hi, this is Sherry West, and you're on the couch with my brother, Dr. Dave. Hey, what are you doing on the couch with my brother?
Thanks for that transition, Sister Sherry. That's a signal that it's time for us to take a quick dip into the mailbag. So here's one. Hi, Dr. Dave. I just wanted to tell you again how much I enjoy your podcast. I was listening to the show about Tarot, and you voiced some of your concerns about your show. I don't remember what concerns I voiced, but so I just wanted to say how much I appreciate what you're doing and how it has profoundly affected my life for the better. Gee, that's great to hear. I was hoping to get your take on a dream I had recently. I've been having strong doubts about the relationship I'm currently in. I love my boyfriend very much, but I think I've come to the realization that I don't want to marry him. I had a dream where I was in a house with some people I knew, no one in particular, but just people I was familiar with, and there was a psychic there, and she told the fortune of one of the people there, and it was very accurate, and I thought to myself, I have to ask her about my relationship. She managed to slip away, but right after she drove off, I went to catch her, and she approached me very eagerly and said, I have to tell you something. You need to stick it out and see what happens. Although the message is very clear, I'm unsure of where it comes from. Is it my fear of being alone that is saying this, or does it come from a deeper place? Hope you might have a fresh take on it. Ciao. Keep the podcast coming. Susie, P.S., any plans for shows about relationships? I could use some advice. Well, Susie, I don't know how much help I can be. You know, that's the frustrating thing about dreams, I find. I often struggle with the same question myself in terms of, does it mean this or does it mean the opposite? There's always a certain ambiguity. And if you don't have a strong sense, I mean, to me, it seems like it was a very strong dream and pretty clear. But if you don't have a strong sense that this psychic in your dream was giving you the advice you need to hear, then I think maybe the best approach is to keep tracking your dreams and see if this stick it out and see what happens message is a consistent theme. And yes, I'll keep my eye out for a good guest to talk about relationships. Personally, I wouldn't presume to. I've had an interesting email exchange with Brother Bernard Seif, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, who is not only a listener but also a psychologist, a practitioner of Chinese medicine and Qigong and other, I think, Chinese martial arts, and a Catholic monk. I think he'll make a fascinating guest, and he says he's up for it. So let's be looking forward to that show. He also expressed the opinion that this show would benefit from some more energetic intro and outro music. Now, that's something I've considered in the past. Don't be surprised if I mess with it a bit. And if you have any great PodSafe intro or outro ideas, send me the MP3. Next, we hear from David in Sweden, who opens with a Swedish greeting, which I'm about to butcher. He says, Hejsan, Dr. Dave, or is it Hejsan, Dr. Dave? It's spelled H-E-J-S-A-N. And he says that means hi in Swedish. So, Hejsan, back to you. I'm a psychology undergraduate, and I just wanted to thank you for your great podcast. It really is one of the best shows out there. I always listen to you and your guests' fascinating conversations on my everyday walks. Hey, that's how I listen to podcasts, too. I also like to make a suggestion for a future interview. I had this synchronicity moment yesterday after reading some articles by another blogger slash podcaster, and I got this sudden thought, Dr. Dave must interview this guy. His name is Steve Pavlina, and he's all about self-development. At first glance, he may look like your ordinary self-proclaimed self-help, I want your money guru. Oh, great, we need another one of those. But if you read some of his articles, like the Meaning of Life series, and listen to some of his podcasts, I think you'll find that he's really doing it from the inside out. Plus, he's done some interesting experiments, like polyphasic sleep. And I'm not even sure what that is. That's a new one on me. He's not a trained psychologist, but I think there's a strong connection to psychology in the topics he covers. You can visit his homepage at www.stevepavlina.com. That's S-T-E-V-E-P-A-V-L-I-N-A.com. And David goes on to say, you both inspire me. Keep on keeping on. Best wishes from Sweden, David, psychology undergraduate. And David, I did go to Steve's website, and he does look like an interesting guy. And so I'll check him out a little bit more. I haven't listened to one of his podcasts yet, but I will listen. Send me a recommendation for which one you think might be the best one for me to listen to. And then maybe we'll go down that road. So I think that better wrap it up for today. Again, I'm running kind of long. Don't forget, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails on Skype where our name is ShrinkPod. And please, please leave me those transitions on MyChingo. You'll find the logo on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. And if you've got a microphone on your computer, it's real easy to record. If you don't and you live in the U.S., you can leave a recording on voicemail at 206-888-2746. I love to hear your voices. I think it helps to build community here. And so I guess I want to thank our guest today, Dr. Dawson Church, for a very fascinating interview. I highly recommend his book if you're at all interested in the topic. And I don't know who my guest is going to be for the next show, but I promise you it'll be somebody good. So that's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.